Welcome to the Hyphen Church Podcast, where faith meets the spaces in between. We're here to explore what it means to belong, to grow, and to encounter God in the midst of life's questions and complexities. Whether you're here to listen, reflect, or take a step forward, know that you're in the right place. Let's make space together for what God is doing in us and through us. Now, let's dive into today's message.
We are starting a new series here, which is going to last about 6 weeks through July and August. And we're looking at this idea of one of our core principles, one of our core practices here as a church, as a community of believers, the open table, the idea of coming together, that community is found around the table. Community is found in food, it's found in coffee, it's found in stories, but community is found all of those places around the table. This is the reason that we celebrate communion every week, because we find that the reason that we come together as people is to celebrate the table, to celebrate what Christ has done for us in our lives and your lives, and not just individually, but as a community, as a group of believers, what that means for us. And so living the way of welcome, how can we practice living out welcome in our life? How can we practice moving through the world in our lives and our day to day, our Monday through Saturday? How can we practice being people of welcome? How can we be more hospitable? How can we be more open? How can we be more inviting? We want to be an inviting church, but are we living up to that? Are we practicing those welcoming behaviors? And so that's what we're going to sort of look at through the book of Luke. We're going to find a number of passages, and I'm going to guarantee that you're going to get uncomfortable with today's. I'm just going to put that out there. Jesus makes us uncomfortable. He should make us uncomfortable. And so when we unpackage this story today, it's going to make us a little bit uncomfortable. Jesus is going to take us and drop us in a place that we don't really like to be in very often. And so we don't go to those places, right? But today we're going to, because you don't have a choice, unless you want to go with the kids. They have good snacks. We're going to read this morning from Luke 10, and this is everyone's favorite story. Might be a stretch, but everyone knows this one. This is the parable of the Good Samaritan, and we're going to put this into context, and we're going to understand a little bit more about what this means for our lives today. And so it's found in Luke 10, 25 through 37. It'll be up here on the screen for you, or you can use an improved electronic device or a good old-fashioned Bible if you still have one of those. Luke writes this: "On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. 'Teacher,' he asked, 'what must I do to inherit eternal life?' 'What is written in the law?' Jesus replied. 'How do you read it?' He answered, 'Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself.' 'You have answered correctly,' Jesus replied. 'Do this and you will live.' But he wanted to justify himself. So he asked Jesus, 'And who is my neighbor?' Verse 30, in reply, Jesus said, 'A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine, and then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he says, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have.' Now, which one of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." And Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise. That's it. That's the sermon. That's the whole thing right there. Go and do likewise. And that's it. We can wrap this whole thing up because we have a really easy time going and doing likewise, right? This is such an interesting story to me, and it's one that gets kind of shied over a lot of times because we're so familiar with it. We're so familiar with the words. We're so familiar with the precept. We're so familiar with the moral of the story. Go and do likewise. I got to act like the Good Samaritan. I got to cross the road. I got to help people in need. I'm going to go and do that when I'm not too busy to do it. I think first and foremost, this is a story about boundaries. And Miranda and I are trying to become better gardeners. We are trying to grow flowers. We're spending lots of money and lots of time and water to do that, but we're getting okay at it. And we had this little strip of dirt in the front of our house that we were like, well, what do we want to do here? What do we want to grow? And I'm like, well, let's grow some wildflowers. I love to see a good wildflower garden, like just natural wildflowers growing there. And so we dumped all the seeds on there. And then they started to come up and they're just green. It's just green. And she's like, it looks like weeds. It just looks like we just didn't weed the dirt here and clean it up. And I said, what do you think wildflowers are? Wildflowers are weeds. Weeds are wildflowers. It's just a matter of our opinion. It's just a matter of our boundaries. That when we can grow wildflowers inside the boundaries of the dirt, inside the garden where we want to put them, they're wildflowers. But when they grow in the cracks on my driveway, or they get into the roses, now they're weeds. This is a story, first and foremost, about boundaries. This is a story about what we put in the box, what we label inside the box and say, here's how I can help. Here's who I can help. Here is who can make a difference in my life. We draw invisible lines all the time. Who deserves our attention? Who deserves our care? Who deserves our effort? Who deserves our time? Who deserves our resources? And the lawyer in Luke 10, I love lawyers, don't you? Because they can ask the questions. He's doing just that. His question to Jesus, who is my neighbor, is really an attempt to justify his limits, to justify his boundaries. And it says that right in the parable. And in order to justify himself, he asks the question, who is my neighbor? Here's the question, really. Here's the question behind the question. It's not who is my neighbor. He knows who his neighbor is, right? He knows the answer. A good lawyer never asks a question that you don't know an answer to. So he knows the answer to who is my neighbor. His question is, who can I safely not love and still be righteous? Who can I walk up to the line and say, I'm sorry, but in order to maintain my righteousness, in order to maintain my holiness, I cannot go there. I cannot love you until you fix yourself, until you get yourself right. The lawyer's question is focused on inheriting something. I want to maintain my status. I want to maintain my righteousness. I want to stay with my eternal life. And who is my neighbor that's going to steal eternal life from me? Who do I have to go and help in order to stay in heaven? But Jesus redirects our attention, doesn't he? He gets to that question behind the question. He redirects our thoughts to the essential commandment of loving God and neighbor. And notice that Jesus stops right there and says, you have answered correctly. Now go and do that. And the lawyer doesn't want to justify his love of God. Who is my God? How do I love my God? Instead, he asks, who's my neighbor? Who am I responsible for? And in fact, who am I not responsible for? He doesn't ask about God. He doesn't say, what are the limits of loving God? How much can I get away with in my life that is up to where God is? He asks about his neighbor, because neighbor is real, right? Loving God is sort of this nebulous thing. Like, you can't question my love of God. You can't know what's in my heart. You can't know these things about me. But you can see if I love my neighbor or not. You can see who I'm responsible for. You can see the people I'm hanging out with. You can see those things. And my neighbors are watching, and the people in my church are watching who I'm helping and who I'm responsible for. So help me, Jesus, here. Clear this up for me. Who as a church are we supposed to love? Who as a church are we supposed to be letting in here to see again? Just tell me, so that I'm not kicked out of the church, or the church is not ostracized in the community, because we wouldn't want to do that. Jesus was never ostracized in his own community. So why would we want to do that? We often want to do the same. We explore how we ask questions that are designed to limit rather than expand our responsibility. How much can I get away with? What's the bare minimum of effort that I can put into this? Oh boy, kids are good at that, right? Oh, again, Sadie asks all the time, how much do I have to eat in order to get a cookie? And this is what we want. We want the bare minimum effort put into this, so that I can get the reward and I don't have to expand my responsibility. I don't have to be in charge of someone else's, of their things that they're going on in their life. We want to do the same. We define neighbor so narrowly that it excludes anyone that is inconvenient or unknown or uncomfortable. And so asking the question, who is my neighbor, challenges the common view on love and responsibility. And it points to Jesus' teaching that love is action-oriented. But I think the whole purpose of these two questions does this. Jesus says, you want to love God? Show it by loving your neighbor. That you can love God in your heart, and God will know that, and that will be great for you. That's a great retirement plan for you. But you want to show other people that you love God? Love his people too. Okay, I can love people that look like me. I can love people that think like me. I can love people in my community. I can love people that aren't actively looking to destroy me. Ha ha. Oh boy, Jesus didn't say that though, did he? Because what we see is that Jesus expands the boundaries. Jesus flips the lawyer's questions. Instead of saying, here's how I define a neighbor, he says, here's how to be a neighbor. Instead of saying, this is what a neighbor is, this is who your neighbors are, he describes how to be a neighbor. The man beaten and left for dead is deliberately unnamed, unidentifiable. He's a universal figure of human suffering. And the priest and Levite represent societal norms where self-preservation and indifference to others' pains, that's the prevailing thought in the world. That I'm sorry that you're suffering. I'm sorry that you feel bad. Here's a list of things that you can do to feel better. Here's a book to read to feel better. I don't want to get involved with anyone's life or anyone's problems, because then things start to get messy. It really invites us to reflect on our propensity to overlook people in need, and challenges us to recognize opportunities for compassionate action. Society's divisions and barriers and the walls that we put up and the boundaries that we create unnecessarily in our communities and in our lives, they're overcome with love. They're overcome with compassion. The priest and the Levite, they were religious insiders, and they pass by. And people have tried to, throughout the centuries, tried to figure out, well, why, maybe they were worried about purity. Maybe they didn't want to touch what they thought was a dead body because they were trying to be pure. But that's wrong. And I'll tell you why it's wrong. And I'll tell you why we know it's wrong. Because Jesus very cleverly says a man was walking down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And the priests and the Levites were following down from Jerusalem to Jericho, which means that they did not need to worry about their purification rituals anymore. They were leaving the temple. They were going back home. So it wasn't purity standards. And in fact, there was Jewish law that superseded this one, that you could touch a dead body if you were helping to bury it, or you were helping to get that person back to life, or trying to find medical care. There were other laws that superseded those. In fact, you could tend to a person's care and health even on the Sabbath. You could break your Sabbath rest to help a person in need. So it wasn't that. We know that. The best explanation I've heard for the refusal of the priest and the Levite to come to the aid of the man in the ditch comes from a well-known pastor named Martin Luther King Jr. He preached, "I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible these men were afraid." And so the first question that the priest and the Levite asked was, "If I stop to help this man, what will happen to me?" But then the Good Samaritan came by and he reversed the question. "If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him?" And King went on to Memphis, and there he was assassinated. There are bandits on every road. What will happen to this man if I don't stop to help? And then comes the Samaritan, a social and religious outsider despised by the Jews. This is centuries and centuries of hatred. Without wandering too far into the woods, the Jews lived in the southern kingdom of Judea. They are called Jews for that reason. Judea, Jews. Samaritans lived in the northern kingdom of Israel. Their capital was Samaria. They were called Samaritans. And the two kingdoms, when they split, they decided that their temples were the actual home of God. And so you have Mount Zion in Jerusalem, the capital of Judea. You have Mount Gerizim, the capital in Samaria. And the two bodies believed that they had the overall rightness to this. And then their temple was destroyed, and the Jews' temple was destroyed, and they continued to go at it back and forth, back and forth. And the Samaritans were hated by the Jews, and the Jews were hated by the Samaritans. Samaria today has various other names, by the way. The West Bank, Palestine, Gaza, Greater Israel. In fact, to hear the parable today, we only need to identify the people in this story. We only need to reassign their identities and their figures. Imagine I'm an Israeli Jew on my way from Jerusalem to Jericho, and I've been attacked by thieves and beaten and stripped and robbed and left half dead in a ditch. And the two people who should have stopped to help me pass by, the first, a Jewish medic from the Israeli Defense Forces, and the second, a member of the Israeli-Palestine Mission Network of the North American Missionary Board. But the person who takes compassion on me and shows me mercy is a Palestinian Muslim whose sympathies lies with Hamas, a political party whose charter not only anticipates Israel's destruction, but also depicts Jews as subhuman demons responsible for all the world's problems. The problem with that story is the good Hamas doesn't preach as well, does it? The good Taliban hospital just opened up. We're not going there, are we? We'll go to the good Samaritan hospital, but the same thing that we're saying is what they're saying there. Those don't preach as well, though. That makes us uncomfortable. The example that Jesus has used here, I'm using a real world example from our modern times to feel how they would feel about Jesus using a Samaritan in this. Yes, they were just as uncomfortable as we are when we go close to that edge. The good Hamas, the good Taliban. Jesus places the enemy in the role of the hero, and he calls the religious people to now imitate what they're doing. Which of these do you think was the neighbor? The lawyer can't even bring himself to say the word Samaritan. He just says, the one who showed mercy. This is Jesus expanding the definition of neighbor. He goes beyond borders. He goes beyond religion. He goes beyond comfort. He purposely makes us feel uncomfortable because he wants us to understand that this is not about boundaries. This is not about limiting our scope of how we can help people, but expanding it to open tables. Now, in the game we often play as pastors and preachers and congregation members, and we're trained and we're taught when we read this story, think about who you identify with in this story. Think about where do you fit into this thing here? Are you more like the priest who hurried by? And typically as children, we're taught to be like the Good Samaritan and help, and not many of us are putting ourselves in that ditch. But I would argue that you're going to identify more with the person in the ditch than anyone else in the story. How do I know? Because of the audience that Jesus had. He was not preaching at the moment to priests and Levites. He was not preaching at the moment to Samaritans. He wasn't preaching at the moment to thieves and robbers. He was preaching to people in the ditch. He was preaching to people who found themselves in the worst possible spot in their lives. Who had been down the road so many times and knew the trouble. They knew the difficulties. They knew the dangers of walking there. And they had to do it anyway because they had no choice. And whatever came upon them, whatever put them in that ditch, Jesus says, I want you to know that the one person who's going to come and rescue you might not be the person you expect at all. Because remember, I said this was a story about boundaries, and it's not about our boundaries, but it's about who do you want to accept help from? Are you going to be rescued by someone you hate? Are you going to be bailed out of a bad situation by someone who actively despises you? Is that what makes us uncomfortable more than anything? Maybe on a good day, we might stop by the side of the road and help someone with a bumper sticker that doesn't align with our political beliefs. We might do that on a good day if we're running 10 minutes early. We might help pay for someone's groceries, maybe, on a good day. But who are you too proud to take help from? Who are you leaving out of the equation to say, no, 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 they can't possibly teach me anything. They possibly couldn't rescue me. They possibly don't have anything to bring to this thing that we're doing, to this place that we are. This is as much a story about God's grace to us when we cannot help ourselves. See, the lawyer is coming up for a position of privilege and power in which he gets to decide who he is going to be godly toward. And Jesus flips us to say, when you recognize your helplessness, from where can you expect help? Usually where you least expect it. To love our neighbors as ourselves means to actively participate in their well-being and to extend grace and support to those outside our cultural or social circles. That's where the Samaritan finds the man. That's where Jesus meets us, to be actively participating in the help and health and security of our community, even to people outside of our normal social circles. This suggests that his kindness, the Samaritan's kindness, the true model of neighborly love that comes from the enemy, it shows that this is a bridge to Christ's sacrificial love. The road is risky, but that's where love lives. Who proves to be a neighbor? And instead of asking who deserves my help, we should ask, how can I become the kind of person who sees needs and responds? How can I do that? Because here's the thing. I think help is going to cost us something. The Samaritan took the man to the inn and he paid the 2 denarii. And he says, I'll be back through here again to pay whatever else it is. I say, gosh, well, you know, I don't have a lot of resources. Yeah, that's right. We don't have a lot of resources. Nobody has a lot of resources. But somehow God always gives resources, doesn't he? He always puts people in the path. He puts people in the way that we are meant to help with what we already have. That's been provided for us. True neighboring has financial implications. It will cost something. So what does this look like? How can we become people that want to do that? First of all, we need to expand our definition of what a neighbor is. We need to look at that garden in the beginning and we need to say, these aren't weeds, these are wildflowers. Everything is open here. Expand those boundaries, or even, can you get there? Take your boundaries away. That one day we all are seen as God's children. We're all seen as the creation of one king. Who have I labeled not my problem? We love that phrase, don't we? Who have I labeled not my problem? Who are people that I walk past both physically and emotionally and spiritually that we say, not my problem? Someone else will be along to take care of that. Second thing we need to do is we need to practice interruptible mercy. You didn't think I was going to say that one, did you? Because this Samaritan was on his way to someplace else. This Samaritan was in the business of doing something else when someone crossed his path. And we need to get in the habit of understanding that our lives can be interrupted if we stop and help. That mercy is interruptible. Hospitality rarely fits into our calendar. We need to be open to divine detours where mercy matters more than our own plan. That God is planning something. And it might not be your path, it might not be their path, but somehow you're there together. How is God using you in that moment to say, you know what? Let's take a little bit of a detour. Let's figure out what's going on here. The third thing we need to do, and this is the hardest one, and I understand it is, we need to be comfortable with indiscriminate compassion. We need to be comfortable with indiscriminate compassion, or we need to be comfortable with our uncomfortableness and our indiscriminate compassion. The command of Jesus to love one another is never circumscribed by nationality or status or ethnic background or sexual preference or inherent lovableness of the other person. We're going to meet messy people that don't belong to us, that don't believe the things we believe. They're going to have histories and they're going to be dirty and they're going to be messy. And Jesus says, love them anyway. I sent them to you for a reason. Love them anyway. You don't agree with them? I don't care. I wouldn't put a number on it, but 80% of the people that ever came in contact with Jesus didn't like him, didn't believe him, didn't believe the things he had to say, didn't like the things he had to say. And I think if I remember correctly, he got killed for it. So if you think you're better than Jesus, that's fine. You can polish your little halo and this sermon's not for you. But for the rest of us, what I'm trying to say is God is going to put someone in your path that you don't agree with. And he says, love them anyway. Go and do likewise. The other, the one person who has a claim on my love is anyone to whom I'm able to respond, which of these three, in your opinion, was neighbor to the man who fell in with the robbers? Go and do likewise. The one who treated him with compassion, that's who is our neighbor. The insistence on the absolute discriminant nature of compassion within the kingdom is a dominant perspective of almost all of Jesus' teachings. So what is indiscriminate compassion? Anthony DeMello from his book, The Way to Love, writes this. Take a look at a rose. Is it possible for the rose to say, I shall offer my fragrance to good people and withhold it from bad people? Or can you imagine a lamp that withholds its rays from a wicked person who seeks to walk in its light? It could only do that by ceasing to be a lamp. And observe how helpless and discriminately a tree gives its shade to everyone. Good and bad and young and old, high and low, to animals and humans and every living creature, even to the one who seeks to cut it down. This is the first quality of love. It's indiscriminate character. So choose this week one intentional act of love that pushes you beyond your comfort zone, that pushes you beyond your boundaries. Maybe it's a difficult phone call. Maybe it's a conversation with a neighbor you've never spoken to. Maybe it's bringing a meal to someone on the margins. Maybe it's sitting with someone who makes you uneasy. Jesus doesn't say, feel something. Jesus doesn't say, sit around and discuss who is your neighbor. Jesus says, go and do likewise. The goal of this parable is not admiration. It's not to be a good person. It's not to see good people. It's not to seek them out. It's imitation. Go and do likewise. There are three attitudes in this text. The thief's attitude is, what is yours is mine and I'll take it. The attitude of the priest and the Levite is, what's mine is mine and I'll keep it. And the attitude of the Good Samaritan is, what's mine is yours and I will share it. And when we do, we don't just become good neighbors. We become more like Jesus, who saw us on the side of the road and had compassion and said, whatever you want, even my life, is yours. Where is God calling you? Whose path has he put you on?